Rose is coming to the plate. Let's document the story now.
Hard hit ball. That's the second baseman, Gilbert, and Pete Rose has done it. A base hit.
Pete Rose has 36. He's trying to tie it up. There it is. Oh, and is he delighted?
It's the story of Charlie Hustle. Pete Rose made hit after hit after hit in his 23 years in baseball, most of them with the Cincinnati Reds. In 1985, he broke the all-time Major League Baseball hit record.
2-1 pitch from Shaw into left center. There it is! Rose has eclipsed Cobb. That's number 4,192.
After that, he managed the Reds and compiled a winning record and four straight second-place finishes in the division. He was an active legend. But then, things fell apart. In 1989, reports surfaced that Rose was in violation of Major League Baseball's Rule 21D.
Jerry, we have obtained a copy of it. As you say, it is a thick copy. It's volume one of nine volumes. And in it, it says Pete bet on Major League Baseball and on the Reds. That is what baseball's investigator is saying.
For those of you not familiar with Rule 21D, basically, you can't bet on a baseball game if you're in baseball. Rose denied all the charges and refused to cooperate with the investigation.
I'm happy to look into the camera now and say I never bet on baseball and I never bet on Cincinnati Red baseball.
But by the end of 1989, Rose was hit with a permanent ban from the game.
The banishment for life of Pete Rose from baseball is the sad end of a sorry episode. One of the game's greatest players has engaged in a variety of acts which have stained the game. And he must now live with the consequences of those acts.
Commissioner Bart Giamatti there announcing the lifetime suspension. Rose would not be eligible for the Hall of Fame or ever manage again. It took 14 years for Rose to finally come clean. Here he is with ABC's Charles Gibson in 2004.
Did you bet on baseball?
Yes, I did. And that was my mistake, not coming clean a lot earlier.
Did you bet on your own team?
Yes.
In the meantime, Congress decided to take action against sports betting in general. In 1992, Congress passed the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act, also known as PASPA.
Government should not be in the business of encouraging people, especially young people, to gamble.
If sports gambling is utilized for revenue, state governments, not just racketeers, will be defrauding the public.
The law banned states from authorizing sports gambling and conducting sports lotteries, although it exempted several states that already had legal sports betting. PASPA has been a part of professional and amateur sports for decades now. And then on Monday, the Supreme Court ruled PASPA unconstitutional. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and the end of PASPA is where we begin our show today. Daniel Wallach is a gaming and sports attorney and partner at Becker & Polyakov. Thanks for being with us, Daniel.
Thanks for having me on.
So what were the original intentions of this law, and has it been challenged before?
PASPA was enacted in the aftermath of the Pete Rose betting scandal at a time when gambling industry was not as expanded as it is today in the United States. It was pre-internet, and the design of the law was to stop the spread of sports gambling. But as a political compromise, Nevada, Delaware, Montana, and Oregon were grandfathered under the original law because they had pre-existing, sports, gambling environments, and those states did not want to lose their entitlement to offer sports betting. So pre-internet, it was designed to stop the spread of sports betting, but 25 years later, everything has changed. Casino gambling is prominent in at least 30 states. And with the growth of the internet, the ability to wager online in illegal, marketplaces and illegal websites is unencumbered. So the law stopped being effective more than 20 years ago and has essentially, channeled all of this wagering activity to offshore markets where there are no consumer protections, and the gaming industry, the U.S. gaming industry and states and the federal government, no one can monetize it. So I think it's out of a desire to kind of move forward and understand the reality of today's times, where with a mouse click or an app or a mobile phone, one can easily bet.
Now, New Jersey was the state that presented the challenge. Why New Jersey?
In the last decade, New Jersey, among a number of other states, were experiencing severe, budgetary shortfalls. And the gaming industry, the casino industry in New Jersey, as well as the racing industry, were going through some hard times. So the goal of the legalized sports betting in New Jersey was to sort of correct the budget deficit and save the racing industry in New Jersey. There have been several track closings and four casinos have closed with competition from surrounding states. Atlantic City and Monmouth Park Racetrack were really facing a fight for their survival.
And I just want to clarify for our listeners, the Supreme Court in this decision allows states to legalize sports betting, but that's not the same as states legalizing sports betting, right?
Well, I think that's an important point you're making. The Supreme Court did not broadly legalize sports betting yesterday. It removed the barrier that had been imposed on state governments, prohibiting state governments from making their own policy decisions as to whether or not to legalize sports betting. So as a result of yesterday's decision, states are now free to make their own determinations. Some will keep it illegal, whereas many others will probably create a legal and regulatory environment because it's a huge moneymaker, and it will revitalize the casino and the horse racing industries of those states. Because as I mentioned earlier, at least 30 states now have vibrant commercial, gaming environments. And of course, from the state tax revenue side, it will bring, in most states, in excess of 8 figures annually in new tax collections, as well as drive tourism.
And where does you mentioned the tax money. We're trying to figure out sort of where does that money end up going?
It will vary by state. For example, in Florida, the proceeds or tax collections on gambling revenues from slot machines, they will go to a general education fund to bolster and create new educational programs and help schools. But other states may direct it to some general budget. Regardless, that is money, newfound money, that states can use in any way they see fit. And those determinations will have to be made by each individual state as to where to best allocate it. But certainly in some states, education is the main beneficiary of gambling, tax collections.
Now, this is just specific to sports betting, correct? What about other sports outlets like the NFL, the NBA, the NHL? Where do they stand when they see a decision like this?
Their biggest the leagues have two concerns. One, safeguarding the integrity of their sports, because the worst thing that could possibly happen to these leagues is that there's a betting scandal or a match fixing scandal. So from the league's vantage point, the spread of state authorized sports gambling could be seen as problematic because states are going to go about things in different ways. No two states will be alike. And with sports corruption being so prominent worldwide and you have a fixed match or any kind of a corrupt scenario, it could really undermine public confidence in the games. So what the leagues want to see is a more harmonized framework where states will have similar laws, from one state to the other, but that is not how things are unfolding. So where the leagues see this headed ultimately is through a new federal law that will create uniform standards across the country, because one of the problems with sports gambling, unlike casino gambling, is that the activity takes place across state lines, it's cross-border, it's interstate, whereas dice games and slot machines solely confined to a casino where it can be much more easily regulated and monitored by state regulators. So for the leagues to be truly comfortable here, they will need to see some kind of a cross-border cooperation and information sharing and an early reporting system. And something like that works more effectively with an overarching federal framework than it does when you move from one state to the next. Just imagine if our stock market, instead of being a national securities exchange, were consisting of 50 separate, state securities exchanges. It wouldn't make any sense, and it would be inefficient and lead to, it would slow down the reporting and cooperation among stakeholders.
And also just for our listeners, and some folks might be more familiar with what this is in terms of betting and on certain teams, but for those listeners who aren't, are we talking about something that could ultimately impact if I bet on a fantasy football or, fantasy baseball league, or just, is this small-scale betting that would be affected, or is this, what kind of betting are we talking about?
We're talking about the whole big-time business of sports wagering on all sporting events in all amounts, large and small. There will be no limits on the amounts of the wagers that can be placed. The higher the bets, the better. What states want to accomplish here is to capture as much of the illegal betting market as possible. I think you will begin to see what's common in Europe, which are in-play wagers. Instead of betting on the point spread before the game, and an increasingly popular form of betting is to wager on the events as they unfold during the game. So if a team is losing, you might get better odds, you know, during the first quarter. So I think the betting is going to be very widespread and full scale with very few limitations other than certain kinds of exotic bets that might raise or might create, you know, risks of, you know, fixing or corruption, like who might commit the first foul of the game. The leagues want to place certain limits on the types of in-play bets that are made, especially those that are more prone to manipulation or control by a single player.
We're talking about betting here. So the question is, with this, who's the biggest winner and who's the biggest loser?
Biggest winners have to be the casino industry and the horse racing industry, because their venues will now receive an adrenaline shot of a new form of wagering that will draw in new customers, millennials. I mean, the racing industry has historically been associated with an older clientele. And when you introduce sports wagering at a thoroughbred racetrack or a harness racetrack or even a dog track, it's going to bring in new patrons, more patrons, younger patrons. So I think by and large, the gambling industry will receive a big time, long-term benefit. It will be one of the most profitable forms of wagering in those venues, not just simply because of the bets that are made, but because of the visitors that are attracted to your facility by virtue of having a sports book or having a big Super Bowl party or an NCAA Final Four event. You can create big events that are surrounded by the whole sports wagering enterprise. The sports leagues, on the other hand, will see the values of their teams and franchises grow, because the leagues are going to monetize this in, you know, every which way possible, through sponsorships, by getting a percentage of the betting revenues in each state potentially, and by, most importantly, selling their real-time data and statistics and live video feeds to gaming operators to power the in-play, you know, wagering environment. So the leagues and the casinos both are going to win big time. The athletes themselves, by virtue of having more revenues driven into the sports leagues, I think the average salaries will probably increase incrementally to correspond with the increase in revenues that the leagues receive. So the only people who are disappointed by this might be those who are opposed to gambling expansion and those who are concerned about the addictions and compulsive activity that might be generated by legal sports betting.
Daniel Wallach is a gaming and sports attorney and a partner at Becker and Polyakov. Thanks for being with us, Daniel.
Thank you very much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
This is The Takeaway, podcast edition. If you like what you hear, tell your friends about us. We're on Twitter and Facebook at The Takeaway. Let us know what you think. Leave us a comment, a question, or a strongly worded letter, and we may read it on air.
We're talking wealth this week on The Takeaway, so let's do some pretty easy math here. If you're white and living in the Boston area, the median net worth for your household is just over $247,000. And if you're black?
$8. That's not 80, that's not 800, that's $8.
$8. Are you shaking your head? I sure am. That's William Darity, who goes by Sandy, and he's the director of the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke University. He studied this with the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston. The racial wealth gap is a persistent problem and has barely changed over time, not just in Boston, but across the entire United States, where for every dollar a white family has, a black family holds just 5 to 10 cents.
Black households, where the head has a college degree at the median, have less wealth than white households where the head has never finished high school.
I spoke with Sandy Darity about the racial wealth gap and how decisions and policies made over 200 years ago continue to affect us today.
We just released a report called What We Get Wrong About Closing the Racial Wealth Gap. And the motivation for that report was to address the perception that many, many people in America have, the perception that the reason why black people have so little wealth must be attributable to certain kinds of behavioral deficiencies, bad judgment, ignorance about finances, and the like. And we released this report to demonstrate that that perception is absolutely wrong. The fundamental reason we have these huge disparities is because previous generations of African Americans have not had the capacity to bestow the same levels of resources on their children and grandchildren that previous generations of white Americans have been able to do. And we have to actually go back and look at the whole historical process of how black Americans have been deprived or denied the opportunity to accumulate any significant amount of wealth over the course of almost two centuries. And I would argue that the starting point is really the failure of the federal government to provide the promised 40 acres and a mule to the formerly enslaved black folks in the aftermath of the Civil War. That's the beginning of this huge gulf in wealth that exist in American society.
And that's a critical point. I wonder if we could touch on some of the other major historical markers in addition to the federal government's failure to actually make good on the promise of 40 acres and a mule. What happened after that in subsequent decades that really led to this gap?
So there were a number of forks in the road in black wealth accumulation where the society took the wrong fork. So the first is the failure to provide 40 acres and a mule. The second is the wave of violent white massacres that took place throughout the United States between the period of Reconstruction, largely up until about 1950, that led to mass amounts of black land loss, property loss, and life loss. But there was a host of these. There was a wave of them in the state of Florida, and in the case of the town of Ocoee, Florida, 500 black residents disappeared virtually overnight, and the disappearance was attributable to the murder of some and to the forced exile of others. And subsequent to that disappearance, the property that was possessed by those black families and households was taken over and reappropriated by a tribunal that was established by the white residents of Ocoee. And that's just an example of the way in which these waves of violence were used for the purposes of denying black accumulation of wealth. To compound that, we can also associate the lynching trail throughout the South as a trail of property appropriation by whites. And so that goes hand in hand with this process. In addition, if we look at the post-World War II policies that promoted social mobility in the United States, those policies were heavily racialized, so they disproportionately benefited white Americans. And I'm including here the effects and consequences of the GI Bill, the introduction of various forms of home mortgage subsidies that were provided by the federal government. The way in which these programs were administered largely denied blacks who otherwise would have been eligible for these types of supports from receiving them and largely bestowed those kinds of opportunities on white Americans. So actually, we could argue that there's a host of social policies that have been pursued in the United States or not pursued, as in the case of the failed allocation of 40 acres and a mule, that have resulted in the conditions that we observe today, where older generations of black Americans simply do not have the kinds of resources that older generations of white Americans have.
I'm speaking with Sandy Darity, director of the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke University, and we're talking about the racial wealth gap in the United States. I'm also wondering, we know that the racial wealth gap between white Americans and black Americans is the largest, but what about Latino Americans, Asian Americans? What trends do we see there?
So with respect to Latinos, the kinds of disparities that we're describing are quite similar, maybe slightly smaller, but very similar. Maybe at best, Latinos have about 12 cents to the dollar of net worth at the median. In comparison with whites. On the other hand, with respect to Asian Americans, we have a somewhat different situation, and it depends largely upon which Asian American national origin community we're talking about. So in our cross-city study, we found, for example, that Koreans who are located in Washington, D.C., have a relatively high median net worth. But Koreans who live in Los Angeles are actually among the segments of the population with a comparatively lower median net worth. So there's a variation within national origin groups depending upon where they're located geographically.
This is a really complicated issue with a very complicated and historical, long historical past. In fact, I've seen data that says it's going to take more than 200 years to close the gap between white and black Americans.
Actually, I'd like to, to make a mild correction on that. That study doesn't say that it will take 200 some years to close the gap. What that study says is it will take more than 200 years, given current trends, for blacks to attain the level of wealth that whites currently have.
That's an important distinction, and you've actually looked at ways to move that along more quickly, right? What are some of the solutions you think, or you're suggesting?
If we are thinking about a direct attack on the racial wealth gap, then we do need a program that would be the equivalent of a reparations initiative. We would need a program that actively transferred a significant amount of resources to the Black American community as a wealth-building strategy. And I would actually argue that the magnitude of the reparations program should be anchored on the size of the racial wealth gap. So I would take the racial wealth gap and I would measure that, and then I would compute what the magnitude of a reparations bill should be on the basis of that disparity or that difference. But there's another possible program that doesn't necessarily have to be an alternative. It could be a complement to this program. And it's a proposal that Derek Hamilton and I have talked about that we refer to the baby bonds proposal. Now, to be clear, this is not actually a bond. Rather, it's a diversified portfolio that functions as a trust fund for each newborn infant in the United States. So unlike the reparations program, this would be a universal program. It would be applicable to all newborn infants who are born in the United States. And here the idea is that the amount of the trust fund would be graduated on the basis of the wealth position of the child's family. So, for example, children who are born into the wealthiest families in the United States, because we want this to be a universal program, we would give them a token trust fund of about $50. For children who are born into the nation's poorest families with respect to their wealth position, we would give them $50,000 to $60,000 in a trust fund. And we would ensure that these trust funds received a real rate of interest of 1% per annum, at least. They would get an instrument that they could use to build assets over the course of their entire adult lifetime. And this would really reshape the range of opportunities that are available to all Americans.
And this is a problem that's been around for longer than you and I have been around. The question I have is, why has the federal government not addressed this in a more significant, impactful way? I was going to say this current administration may not seem to have any openness to solving the problem, but I don't know if I've seen prior administrations really interested in closing the racial wealth gap in particular.
I don't think that there was ever any significant political pressure placed upon either of the political parties aimed at trying to address the racial wealth gap. And I think that that's the critical factor that would have to come into play. There would have to be a social movement that created that kind of political pressure to bring about the adoption of proposals of this type. And I'm hoping that as we have more extensive and reasoned conversations about why the racial wealth gap exists, it will lead to a greater degree of enthusiasm for programs that would really correct the problem.
William Darity is a public policy professor and director of the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke University. Sandy, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And you're telling us about your wealth.
My name is Scott Johnson. I live in Ada, Oklahoma, and I survive on less than $1,000 a month for disability. I get help from the Chickasaw Nation on things that I can't get. I only get to eat once a day, and if I had more than that money, I wouldn't know what to do with it.
It's Jane calling from San Francisco. Net worth, $150K. The GI Bill allowed me to get a master's degree. And then with marketable skills, I worked 6 days a week for 2 years, saving enough to buy a business for my husband. Now our future looks more secure.
But we're still collecting stories about wealth, particularly if you are a Black or Brown American or you a person of color. Call us with your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
If you like what you're hearing, give us a rating and review us on iTunes. It helps us in ways you can't imagine. All right, now back to the show.
All right, folks, we're back on The Takeaway with another story from our Case in Point series, a look at the criminal justice system and the parts of it that are broken or strange or really just beyond belief. 41 years ago, an all-white jury convicted Johnny Lee Gates, an intellectually disabled Black man, for the murder of a white woman in Georgia.
Police and prosecutors initially had a lead that went in another direction, but they ultimately settled on Johnny Lee Gates. There was a confession, which was videotaped, which was rare for the time. He says, his lawyers say, then and now, that it was a forced confession, it was a flawed confession. But nevertheless, the police basically said that he had done it. There was a sexual assault that was involved, and so it took a all-white jury basically an hour or so to come back with a conviction, and then even less time to come back with a death sentence.
A Supreme Court decision in 2002 spared Johnny Lee Gates the death penalty, and a recent Supreme Court ruling about racial prejudice during jury selection has had his attorneys fighting for a new trial and possibly an exoneration. Andrew Cohen is a senior editor at the Marshall Project, and he's got the story.
This was a crime that had to do with heating and an oil company. There was a problem with the victim's heater. She had called the gas company, and then apparently this perpetrator, the murderer, shows up, and he's not dressed as the gas company employee, and all of a sudden he's led into the house. So there was an eyewitness who basically said that she saw a Black man leaving the premises. The description didn't really fit Johnny Lee Gates, but it was a testimony. And then there was a fingerprint that prosecutors brought into the case later on. And one of the mysteries of this case is when the fingerprint got onto the crime scene. Initially, the police checked the crime scene, and there was no fingerprint of Johnny Lee Gates. There was no physical link to him at the crime scene. But then he went to the crime scene with the police when they taped that confession and essentially traipsed through the crime scene. And then afterward, at trial, all of a sudden, there was this fingerprint. Now, defense attorneys suggest that maybe he touched something when he came in with the police after he was a suspect, and that was used against him in the crime to say that he had been in the apartment at the time of the crime.
And initially he was sentenced to death, but that ended up changing. What was it that helped that process along?
Sure. He was sentenced to death very quickly. It was just around the time that Georgia renewed its death penalty. Remember, there was a couple of year stretch there in the mid-1970s where the death penalty was unconstitutional everywhere. The death penalty came back to Georgia, and Johnny Lee Gates was sentenced to death, but then was around long enough for the U.S. Supreme Court to essentially rescue him. 2002, the U.S. Supreme Court in a Virginia case said that states could not execute the intellectually disabled. And there had been evidence all through the case of Johnny Lee Gates' intellectual disabilities. And so about 15 years ago, his new lawyers at the time, were able to get a hearing with the new Supreme Court precedent and convince prosecutors that they were going to lose if they took the case back to trial. And so Johnny Lee Gates' death penalty became a life without parole sentence, which is what he's serving today.
in the 1970s, when this verdict came down, was there any, or since then, has there been any attention paid to the fact that this there was a lack of physical evidence, that Johnny Lee Gates was, you know, had lower mental capacity, that the confession perhaps could have been coerced, that eyewitness testimony isn't always accurate? All of these things we think about today, has any of that come up since?
Yeah, I mean, all of it's come up in to a certain extent. What's new here is the another Supreme Court decision. Just a few years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court, in another case out of Georgia, overturned a conviction that was based on racial prejudice during jury selection of the trial, where white prosecutors, in a case involving a black murder defendant and a white victim, essentially made sure to strike from the jury pool all black potential jurors for one reason or another. And the justifications given for those strikes were not sufficient to the U.S. Supreme Court. When that ruling came down a couple of years ago, the lawyers in this case, the Gates case, said, wait a minute, this Supreme Court decision may have some relevance in our case. It was about the same time. At least one of the prosecutors was involved in both instances. In our case, the Johnny Lee Gates case, we have a black defendant, a white a victim, a white prosecutor, and an all-white jury. And so they were able, through a series of legal filings and over the challenge of Georgia attorneys, to get access to these notes, notes from the Johnny Lee Gates murder trial made by prosecutors. And the defense says that the notes show the same sort of bias, prejudice, racism, if you will, that was evident in that other case that the U.S. Supreme Court overturned. So the mission for the judge now in Georgia is to decide, yes, whether the similarities are the same so that this case falls into the Supreme Court precedent, the new precedent. And if it does, then it's quite likely that Johnny Lee Gates will at least get a new trial. And given the other problems with some of the other evidence, he may not get a new trial at all. Prosecutors may relent and say, you know what, this is enough. We're not going to win a new murder trial here. We're just going to basically let him go.
And where do we expect the case to go from here? You said we're not sure if we're going to have a new trial or not. Or, I mean, is there the potential for Johnny Lee Gates to be freed?
Yeah, I think there's the potential for there to be a new trial. It's going to depend on what his current judge thinks about the evidence, thinks about those notes from the jury selection long ago, thinks about whether there's a pattern here of prejudice that the U.S. Supreme Court says is unconstitutional and can't be allowed. And it's fascinating for another reason. The same judge that helped ensure that Johnny Lee Gates would get off of death row, the same judge who was leaning towards finding him intellectually disabled 15 years ago, is the judge who is presiding now. So we know that this is a judge in Georgia who is willing to buck up against what the prosecutors want and what state attorneys want. And what they're saying, what Georgia's saying essentially, is that the notes, whatever else they say, don't show the sort of pattern that the Supreme Court has in mind in these racial jury selection cases. And even if it does, Gates didn't raise the argument quickly enough, wasn't diligent enough in trying to get to the bottom of what happened during his jury selection, and that basically bars him from making the argument now.
Thank you so much, Andrew, for being with us today. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
Andrew Cohen is senior editor at the Marshall Project. It's been great talking with you today, and we'll do it all again tomorrow. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.